Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This program is sponsored by Cane Vineyard and Winery. For more information, go to cane5.com.
What do emmer, kamut, farro, and acorn have in common? We're going to find out on today's show. Hi, this is Linda Palacio, and you are listening to A Taste of the Past here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. And indeed, emmer, kamut, einkorn, amaranth, farro, names that some of you have heard, maybe some of you haven't. But within the last 10 years or so, the rise in health and wellness and the increased interest in natural ingredients has reintroduced these names to the market. They have actually revived an interest and a reintroduction of a lot of these long-forgotten cereals. And today I have with me Maria Speck, who has written a wonderful book called Ancient Grains for Modern Meals. And she, in this book, she explains uses for all these grains and describes them, describes what to look for in the market and how to use them in preparation. And I can't wait to learn from her about some of these more unusual varieties. Welcome, Maria.
Oh, hello, Linda. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What I did not mention is Maria has a background in journalism and has written for a lot of publications. And is this your first book, Maria?
This is my first book.
Ah, okay. And this book has actually just, really taken the market by storm, I have to say. A lot, of course, due to your wonderful writing style and the fact
Thank you. You
include so many personal, wonderful personal anecdotes in it that really put us in touch with a lot of our own feelings and memories. And I think it kind of softens the reader's introduction to some grains that they might not really be so ready to try. But reading these stories and then reading the wonderful recipes takes us right into it. Also, and I will say that your recipes and the demos that you've done in conjunction with this book, and it's well known that you conduct some wonderful cooking classes in Cambridge as well. So congratulations. It's great. It's a great book, and it's been out for a year now?
Yes, for a year.
And still going strong.
Yeah.
Well, you have a very interesting background, having grown up in two different European cultures. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to your reintroduction with whole grains and ancient grains.
Yeah, that's really at the center of this book, because I am German and Greek. My dad was German and my mom is Greek. And whole grains were on a table simply as mouth part of, or, you know, whole meals, mouth-watering, sensual, delicious meals. I was never, ever told to eat them because they're oh so good for me. And that was really the key message for me living in the U.S. I've lived in the U.S. since 1993. And whenever I told someone that I love whole grains or that I eat whole grains, people would look at me somewhat, you know, surprised. And then they would say, well, you must live a very healthy life. And that was really not at the center of why I love them. I love them because of that texture. They really have distinct flavors, which are really wonderful, and even marvelous colors that they bring to your table. And at some point, you know, being a journalist, watching trends, I noticed that, you know, Americans were interested in whole grains. And I thought, you know, we have to change the message of grains.
Right.
And that was really the key. And my passion is really to tell people they really can taste very good. And to come back just briefly to my own roots, I mean, anyone who's traveled to Germany has seen the country's amazing loaves of bread, you know, with many different flours, textures. You would have like a whole grain loaf that has millet flour, it might have rye flour, it might have barley, and then it might even have whole kernels. And so suddenly you have all these flavors, and that's what I was missing in the whole debate on grains. So that's just part of it. We can talk more about this.
Well, these so-called ancient grains, and then you will explain a couple of them, and not all of them are necessarily grains, but this ancient grain category, I mean, it's a boon to the food industry as well, because it just, from what I had read, it's estimated that only around 15 cereal crops are grown as staple food. So this reintroduction of these grains is really a way to increase our food diversity, and that's exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting, actually. Also, to see some of these ancient wheats also, you know, being more appreciated. That's a very interesting development in the past few years. These are varieties of wheat, and we can talk more about this in more detail. This is, you know, especially important for people that have gluten sensitivities.
Right.
So that's something that I really like, because I think some of these ancient wheats taste absolutely, they're so distinct, and they have such wonderful character. Wheats like, you know, Kamut, which has like a rich buttery flavor, or there's also Spelt, which, you know, probably a lot more people have heard, and which is having a huge comeback in Europe as well as in the U.S., which is wonderful. And then Farro, of course, a very trendy grain.
Very.
So there's all these, you know, and I love seeing these ancient varieties really coming back to our tables because of the flavor they bring. And also very distinct, again, you know, they're very distinct character, each and one of them. And in the book, what I tried to do was, with the recipes, to pair them, you know, to highlight their distinct flavor. Because, you know, yes, you know, a lot of people think grains are just bland, right, and just kind of this mass on our table.
Right.
And you know, usually they're afraid because of the carbs and all of that, and say they have no flavor. And that's, with all these ancient grains, each and every one of them has a character and a flavor. And that's what I try to do in the book, pairing them with their distinct, you know, to enhance their character, basically.
Right. Well, now we keep saying ancient grains, and some of them, of course, have been with us for centuries, and they were not lost. Many of them were sort of lost to us, to our knowledge. But wheat, of course, not necessarily in our modern form, but wheat has been around for that was one of the earliest crops ever, right? In the Fertile Crescent.
Yes.
So why don't we talk about some of these in particular? Which one, when you were rediscovering some that weren't in your repertoire of foods from your family's background, which were some of the newer ones that you discovered?
I have, you know, the one that I've been more recently been really fascinated is Einkorn, which is a German name, actually. Ein means single and corn means kernel. And so it's really the oldest of all wheats.
Mm-hmm.
So the Italians call it, and that's where some of the confusion on farro comes in, the Italians call it farro piccolo, which means small farro.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's one that I find very interesting. It cooks fairly quickly. It's a tiny kernel, and it's not grown very much yet, but it is having, you know, also a revival. I mean, chefs looking at it. We get a wonderful one from Anson Mills, from the company that I really love. And distinct, you know, plump, aromatic wheat variety that I cherish. Then there's, I mentioned, Kamut, with its rich buttery flavor that I really like, and then Spelt, as well as Emmer. Emmer is another one. That's what we often call farro in the U.S. That's type of the Emmer variety of
mm-hmm.
wheat.
Mm-hmm.
I can detect a hint of cinnamon. I love using Emmer also in baking. It's delicious, has a nuttiness, but as I said, also this hint of cinnamon. In my book, I have farro breakfast, for example, creamy farro with honey roasted grapes. that is really highlights, you know, by using also, of course, cinnamon as a spice. I roast grapes in the oven. I cook the farro with a little bit of anise and cinnamon, and then I drizzle it just with honey and cook it up with a little bit of cream. So it's, or half and half, you know, depending. Wonderful breakfast.
That can make a believer out of anyone.
I tried really hard.
Well, yeah, I do like that in the book you do give sources for people who don't live near places where they might be able to find these grains.
Correct.
And it's great because you do give sources, as you said, Anson Mills, and there's, mm-hmm. you know, King Arthur and Arrowhead Mills. Mm-hmm. So people can research and find mail order sources for a lot of these grains, right?
Mm-hmm. The interesting part, just to add to that, is what's really beautiful is since I wrote the book, because books take a while always to come to market, mm-hmm. it's really wonderful to see that even average supermarkets now are having, you know, their grain selections are becoming bigger and bigger, which obviously has to do also with demand and with the new interest in grains, which is fantastic. I mean, we're not only talking of, you know, health food stores that obviously always had, but their grain sections, you know, have, I think, also become bigger. We have, you know, stores like Whole Foods that have now big bulk sections, and then we have even average supermarkets. I sometimes go and I'm like, wow, they have like red rice, they have black rice.
That's right.
And, you know, and then they have barley, and not just the pearl barley, but they will have a barley that's, you know, somewhat pearled, but still has, you know, some of the fiber retaining and the nutrients. So very interesting. I mean, there is a lot more now that you can find even in your average supermarket, and I love that.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, quinoa has been, that kind of burst onto the scene, about 10 or 15 years ago, is, you know, being this new ancient grain, a new old grain. Everything yeah. new, everything old is new again, right?
Yeah.
and quinoa, that's from the pre-Columbian period, right? So that is not a wheat then, and that's a gluten-free grain, correct?
That's gluten-free, and that's also one of the reasons. I mean, it's a really topic probably by itself to talk about in more detail, but basically, of course, the gluten-free movement has helped, you know, put some of these also, again, back onto our plates, and people get really interested in, like, even grains like millet are being noticed now, which I love because it's a quick-cooking, wonderful, everyday staple that we have completely overlooked, and, you know, and it can be on the table in 10, 15 minutes.
Tell me something about millet, because mm-hmm. you tell a cute story in your book, and we all have to go there, that people think, oh, my God, birdseed. I'm eating birdseed, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I have learned, obviously, to not ever, I use the stealth serving technique for millet, because I learned very quickly that if you tell someone that you're serving millet, they will exactly react like you did just now, oh, my God, bird food. And so I never, ever say I'm serving millet. So what I try is I hide it, and then I make sure that the food is delicious and that people, I have one dessert, for example, a ricotta millet pudding with warm raspberry compote, which is, you know, you cook the millet with, you know, and then you mix it with ricotta, lemon zest, a little bit of heavy cream, and a honey-sweetened warm raspberry compote on top. It's similar to a rice pudding, really, and so it's actually something that people love. I mean, I have yet to find someone who won't lick their bowl clean, but, of course, again, I will never say I'm serving millet. I will only tell it to them afterwards with a grin of a Cheshire cat.
Okay. For that, I'll eat birdseed, right? That's good.
You just said millet. But what I'm saying with that is really, you know, we are talking always, and that was really important for me also with the book. I'm a journalist, so, you know, I'm used to 12-hour days. All my, you know, my whole career, I've worked very hard. I came home in my kitchen often famished with a capital F. I've always eaten whole grains. And that was really important to me in the book. I've tried to make this for our busy lifestyles, to give people an opportunity how to cook whole grains, even if they're super busy. And so what I've done is, and that's something that I find also, you know, I want to tell people about is, I've separated them into quick cooking and slow cooking whole grains because we think grains take forever to cook.
Right.
A lot
That's
of
right.
people think that, right?
You have to and soak
say,
them
no.
and boil them forever.
Exactly, exactly. And so, yeah, so what I'm trying to show is there's actually a lot of grains, whole grains, that can be on our table, what I call the quick cooking ones. This would be the millet that we just mentioned. There is, you know, obviously whole wheat couscous, which just needs a little bit of steaming. There's bulgur, which most of us know only from tabbouleh, but mm-hmm. it's a versatile, you know, it can even just be rehydrated and eaten. I mean, it doesn't even need to be cooked. And so this is from wheat, made from wheat. It's a traditional technique. And then, of course, we have, cornmeal or polenta, which we can cook up fairly quickly, even in a busy weeknight. We have buckwheat. So, and quinoa, which we mentioned already. So there is such a variety of quick cooking grains. When I come home, I look at my shelf and I'm like, oh, I'll eat this tonight. So it's not something that really will take me more than 20 minutes or 15. But then, and that's true, there's slow cooking grains. How can you bring them to your table? What I've done in the book is give people several ways of how to incorporate them. So either, of course, you make them on the weekend because they do need soaking and they benefit from soaking as well as you know, a simmer of 45 to 60 minutes. Mm-hmm. And those are like wheat, of course, you know, whole rye berries, hulled barley, which we call, you know, whole grain barley is called hulled barley. Then we have whole oats, the actual berries, or spelt, or kamut, all of these that I mentioned earlier. So these, yes, they're supremely chewy, and they take longer to cook. But what I sometimes do is I soak them in the morning, I come home, and I turn on the stove, and they simmer while I just, you know, wash my face, change my clothes or something, and then they're halfway through cooking, yeah. You know, when I go to the kitchen. So there's many ways. Again, what I tried in the book is, you can do it. It's not something, you know, you have to stop in your tracks right. eat 3 hours later. It's just a small, you know, sometimes we have to think ahead, you know, just like when we make beans from scratch, for
right,
example.
Right. And you do, and you give a lot of varieties of wonderful recipes that do use these in many different ways, both cook, you know, long cooking and short cooking. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned buckwheat, and that, mm-hmm. I have to say, was, to me, the surprise in the book. But mm-hmm. I didn't realize buckwheat was not, I mean, I've used it. I've used the buckwheat mm-hmm. flour. I've used, mm-hmm. you know, of course, noodles. We always have the soba noodles, but the mm-hmm. buckwheat noodles. I didn't realize that buckwheat is not really a wheat.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell
mm-hmm.
me about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of grains that, you know, they're called pseudo cereals. And because we eat them like a grain, that's why, you know, they're on our plate like a grain. That's why we call them a grain. And buckwheat is one of them. Amaranth, quinoa, these are grasses. Buckwheat is really another, you know, from a herbaceous plant, and it belongs to the rhubarb and the sorrel family. So it only has the name from the Dutch word buckwheat, literally beech wheat, and it refers to the beech nuts, which are larger but have a similar triangular shape. Mm. So it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's all these little, you know, but in the end, I mean, how do we eat it? We eat it like a grain, and it has that, you know, that place on our table like a grain. So I felt really comfortable including all of these.
Right. Well, we are going to find out some more, and we're going to talk about some specific recipes when we come back after a short break.
Cane Vineyard and Winery are proud to support Heritage Radio Network and the growing movement to change the way we eat and think about our planet. For more information, go to cane5.com.
Well, if you thought that eating whole grains and being healthy with natural ingredients meant another brown rice diet and bowls of tabbouleh. Well, we've got news for you. We're here with Maria Speck talking about ancient grains and some fabulous, fabulous recipes, Maria. Some of the pasta recipes are wonderful. And the dessert recipes, I have to say, are so surprising, just really wonderful, and breads as well. What I wanted to have you talk about, you mentioned something on it, and I said those people who were interested in healthy diets, you just eat these because they taste good, right? This was part of your background, and you loved this, but did you not also find that it was kind of a stimulus to a weight loss program as well?
Well, yeah, I want to make this very clear. Obviously, I cherish that whole grains are healthy, right? And I mean, I call them nutritional powerhouses, and I love that. What for me was important was it's the only food group that has the only label that they have attached to them is healthy. And that's where I felt like we've done them a real disservice over the past 15, 20 years by never actually thinking about how good they taste mm-hmm. and how wonderful. And so in my case, absolutely, I they've truly changed my life because as a young journalist, just like everyone, you know, probably once you leave home, I forgot about all the good food at home and all I was eating was something in Germany we call Schokoladenpudding mit Sahne, which is really just from the store shelf. It's a chocolate pudding with whipped cream and frozen pizza. So I was really on it.
Sounds familiar.
On a very, very typical diet. And then a friend of mine served me at some point a wheat berry salad, which was nothing, you know, nothing difficult or anything. She put some vegetables from the farmer's market. She was what we today call a locavore. And, you know, with lemon juice, olive oil. And she just put it in front of me. And again, I was very lucky because she didn't talk about, oh, you have to try the salad. Wheat berries are very good for you. No, she just put this bowl in front of me and said, try this. And for me, that was, I mean, obviously, you know, in my case, you know, brought back some memories, you know, really came full circle, you know, tasting wheat berries again, which I tasted as a child in Greece. And it just made me so curious because of the texture and, again, the flavors they have, and it brought me into the kitchen. And that's where, you know, there's a lot of things that happen when we cook, right?
That's right.
But one thing that was, for me, was important is I tell people really the moment I brought, you know, grains center stage into my life, because I was also, as a young woman, always dieting. I mean, like I would be hard-pressed to think of a young woman nowadays that's not dieting, and I was just the same. And that was really interesting for me because the moment I put grains on my plate, you know, like on the center of my plate and used vegetables, fruits, and like meat and fish just as accents and for flavor, I never ever had to think about dieting again. It was really an amazing transformation. And of course, I do cook. I learned to cook. I stopped eating frozen pizza, which I'm sure contributed.
Yes.
But what was really, that was really for me a wonderful experience because I was not able to diet. I mean, I simply love food so much. So for me, dieting never really worked.
Right. Well, and as you say, you were in the kitchen and you were cooking and you appreciated the food more. You, and in fact, you, many of us who do cook find this to be true. You're touching the food, you're stirring it, you're waiting. There's that anticipation. Mm. Yeah, I think there's a more appreciation. You gave it a name. You called it, we call it mindful eating today and you know, trying in a lot of the weight loss journals. But you called it your truffle theory.
I was very concerned, but I did decide to put it in because it is actually something that I, you know, often thought about in my life that when I prepare, and I have a weakness for a very good piece of chocolate or a chocolate truffle, and at some point I learned to make them. They're very easy to make, especially the basic ganache truffle is very easy to make, which we often don't realize how easy these things are. And so what I learned was that, you know, while normally when you buy, you know, when someone gives you a box of chocolates and you just eat them kind of mindlessly, what you were saying, and you just can't stop eating. But what I found is when I make them and I try some of these homemade, you know, they're, of course, extremely fresh, You know, they're meltingly tender. I can taste the aromas. But I also remember, you know, I went shopping for the ingredients. I rolled them. I waited for them to chill. Right. So it is some, you know, it's not difficult to make, but it has some steps involved. And so that's when, you know, I eat one truffle or two, and that's it. And I'm so happy, and it tastes so good, and I'm so appreciative. And that's what I wanted to say with this when I called it the truffle theory. This was obviously provocative,
right?
In a whole grain cookbook. But it was meant that way, because just to remind people, you know, when you have good food and when you cook it yourself, you also appreciate it more. And that's part of us, you know, when we eat, you know, and we're all guilty of that. I mean, I'm including myself. When I'm busy at the computer, I will eat something at the side, and I try not to, right? But mm-hmm. we all have that, but I always try not to. I mean, for me, that's important when I eat, to appreciate what I eat, actually, you know. So, but that's why I called it, why I ended up calling it a truffle.
Well, it caught my attention, so that was good. You've been doing a lot of demos and talks over this past year for the book. What grain do you, is there one grain that you can think of that maybe people tend to ask most about? Maybe they're more confused about than others? Perhaps not, but I'm just wondering if there's, you know, one that stands out that people ask about often.
I couldn't say that, you know, because people, I mean, that was also a reason why I wrote the book. Something that I've observed and also learned through the past years, people really want to cook with whole grains, but there's so much confusion out there mm-hmm. on, you know, what is actually a whole grain, and, you know, like what I mentioned briefly, what Italians call farro, but what it actually is, and so there's also, you know, a terminology confusion, you know, how do you know that hulled barley is whole grain barley, and so mostly I find that people really want to learn, you know, about the grains, the different grains, and of course they want to taste them. That's what I find the most amazing, that whenever you give people something, they really, it's like an eye-opener, like you were saying, you know, to make desserts with whole grains, that's usually very surprising for people, you know, that you can have whole grains for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and even for dessert. And that's, for me, I mean, it's that's how I've always eaten, and these are the things that I love, and so that's why I put them in. But so it's not so much one grain, but more about how do we cook them? How do we store them?
Right.
How do we store them is a question that people ask a lot. And because they are also found, people are extremely frightened of, you know, and having the grain go bad overnight because it contains the natural oils, the germ, and the bran. And so I try to explain grains are really, you know, that's why we have grains in our diet today, because they brought us over the winter. They're actually very hardy, and no, I mean, except if you store them on a sunny window, grains will not go bad in, you know, many months if you store them in a cool, dark place.
But you do recommend putting them in a jar?
Correct. I recommend, and that's something I've learned in Germany. I love that actually for two reasons. For one is I use just simple mason jars mm-hmm. because they're economical and very, very practical also to use, and you see what you have at one glance, which is great. I think, you know, versus having your bags, you know, digging them out of the fridge somewhere and not knowing what's in there and what you actually have for, you know, as a supply. And then the other thing is obviously it contains, you know, contaminations. If you have it in a jar, you can just take care of it, versus if you keep grains in bags, you know, then you might have a problem potentially. But I think a cool place is definitely recommended, a cool, dark place. And I searched that one out. But again, I mean, grains, even whole grain flours last many months.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing because they do retain all the nutritional elements, don't they? The proteins and the vitamins.
Yeah,
and the fiber.
Yeah, they
certainly
do.
The fiber.
You know, I mean, the very freshly milled flour is certainly the very best. And
that's where I want to go next. That's what I want to talk about.
Exactly. But, you know, one has to be, you know, really think about what is practical for people. So if you're a passionate baker like me, I love, you know, my own bread and my own cookies and scones, and I just love baking, then a grain mill or a grain mill attachment, which some companies offer, is a great investment, because you will just be blown away by the quality of freshly milled flour. And that's actually a big trend right now in the U.S., that bakers look for local grains recommend freshly milled flour because
right. if people don't have their own mills, they're going to granaries that will mill them right there on site.
Correct.
It's, I think that's fabulous.
That's fabulous. We have in Boston, I've been working with one Massachusetts farm, Four Star Farms, very closely in the past year and introducing them to local chefs here because they mill their flour fresh on when you need it. And so if you've ever side by side eaten, you know, the same cooking, I've done that. I've done it also with other people. It is really like when you have a farmer's market tomato in August versus a supermarket tomato in December.
You can really taste the difference of that fresh milled flour, even in a cookie, right?
Anyone will taste this. I can assure you this. I've had the most amazing experience, and I sometimes forget it because when I worked on the book, I used store-bought flours, I have to, because people have to be able to replicate these recipes. Mm-hmm. And then I mill fresh flour and I make some scones, and I'm like, oh, what happened? What's that? Why does it taste so good? And then I'm like, yeah, of course it does taste. So even I, when I, many months, you know, doing the testing of the book, then it goes away, right, from your mind, and then you realize, and it is really that good. So if you're passionate, I think it's a great investment to make or to seek out your local farm that will mill it for you.
And, of course, we have to let our listeners know that this is a woman who has a mill both in her home in the U.S. and in her home in Germany. I mean, you are a serious home miller.
Yeah, and they're of course, indestructible German mills.
Not just so your little hand crank.
It's a very economical thing I've done.
Yeah, that's terrific. Before we go on to a couple of recipes, one thing I wanted to mention was that I wanted to ask you which of the grains, I think we all kind of know because we're familiar, but the ones that have, some of the ancient grains that have had the, let's say, the best comeback performance, which have become, not the ones for you, obviously, because you know all the different ones, but which ones have really caught on and have attracted people's attention?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we mentioned, you know, one that has really caught on, especially with the gluten-free, but as a result also with much of, you know, many chefs and people, is quinoa,
yes,
which we mentioned, which cooks up really fast. It's a wonderful flavor, and it's extremely versatile also, mm-hmm, you know. You can use it in salads, and you can make quinoa cakes with it. You can make dessert with it. Again, really delicious. Another one I mentioned is spelt. Spelt, especially baked goods with spelt, it bakes up beautifully, and so that's a great one, an ancient wheat. And what I haven't mentioned yet is, if you are gluten sensitive, and I'm not talking of people with celiac disease because they should have no gluten whatsoever, mm-hmm, obviously, but there's a lot of people that feel uncomfortable when they eat modern day wheats, which are bred and hybridized and are bred to be easily harvested, that's mm-hmm all. And so they have changed, wheat has changed a lot, basically. Some of the people seem to be able to digest these ancient wheats like spelt, kamut, emmer, which, you know, we also call farro, more easily. And that's very interesting. And yeah, obviously the research, I think, will come. You know, I'm sure people are looking into this, but they seem to be able to digest it, people that are gluten sensitive. And I find that very interesting. So spelt is one. That's, I think, why spelt is having such a comeback. Another one is farro, also in the wheat family.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is, you know, wonderful, plump, and really delicious. And again, can be used in breakfast. I have a farro with white wine and mussels, a stew in the book, which can be cooked up really quickly, even on a weeknight. And so these are the ones I think that are really having a huge comeback. And so what I'm hoping with the book is that some of the others, right, that we really also bring them to our table, especially the quick cooking ones, like I mentioned, you know, millet, bulgur, also, you know, buckwheat you are familiar with,
yes,
even amaranth. I'm working
on that. I'm anxious to try some. I've had it in, you know, cereals mixed in with other grains, but anxious to try something with the amaranth. I think that would be exciting. Well, what we don't have time to go through a recipe, but what I wanted to mention for our listeners that what is surprising, I think, to a lot of people, and also very encouraging and delightful, is that the book is organized. It is a regular cookbook, and it's organized according to, you know, starts and main courses and salads and desserts. So it really does show the versatility And I think you did a wonderful job in that regard. I think that's terrific. Hopefully we'll be able post a recipe for your wheat berry fool with figs. That sounds wonderful.
And try them.
not to think that everything has to be so involved. I mean, you have an artichoke rosemary tart with a polenta crust. I mean, that's almost, I'm going to say ordinary. It's not ordinary, but it's so approachable. And I think it's something that can be such a wonderful introduction for people to be adventurous and try something new. Try something new that is very, very old, right?
Yeah, and it was really important for me to make it sure that really anyone can do that. And I mean, the book has been cooked for 1 year now, and I have, knock on wood, everyone has no problems with the recipes, which is wonderful for me as the author, right?
That's terrific, always something that you feel. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's been really cooked through
that's great.
By a lot of readers. So yeah.
Well, I'm just so thrilled that it is not only a delicious cookbook as you say, the recipes work, but it's a great introduction for people who aren't familiar with these ancient grains and a great way to get them to introduce them into their diet. And I encourage our listeners to take a look and try some of these old grains. Maria, thank you so much. It was an absolute pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed, and thank you for inviting me. It was wonderful.
You've been listening to A Taste of the Past on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.